is Polyphonic Press, the podcast where two music fans pick a classic album completely at random. Using the patented random album generator, they are given an album to review from a curated list of over 1,000 classic releases, spanning multiple genres. And now onto the show. Here are your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke.
Hey, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And let's not waste any time. We've got the patented random album generator right in front of us here. So let's hit the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week.
The album you will be reviewing is Safe as Milk by Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band.
All right.
I have this one on vinyl and on CD, I think. So
cool. So here is a description of the album. It says, Safe as Milk is the debut album by Captain Beefheart and his Magic Band, released in 1967. The record is a wild blend of blues, psychedelic rock, and experimental music, showcasing the unique and often eccentric vision of frontman Don Van Vliet, a.k.a. Captain Beefheart. While rooted in traditional electric blues, Safe as Milk already hints at the avant-garde style that would define Beefheart's later work. The album features intricate guitar work, odd rhythms, and surreal poetic lyrics. It's more accessible than Beefheart's later records like Trout Mask Replica, but still packed with creative risks and strange beauty. The album features a young Ry Cooter on guitar whose contributions helped shape the sound and keep it grounded, even as Beefheart pushed boundaries. Though it wasn't a commercial hit at the time, Safe as Milk has become a cult classic and an essential record for fans of psychedelic and experimental rock. It marks the beginning of one of the most iconoclastic careers in 20th century music. So the album was released in August of 1967. And the genres are blues rock, garage rock, rhythm and blues, acid rock, and folk rock. And was released on Buddha Records, and it was produced by Richard Perry and Bob Krasnow. And we encourage you to listen along, and we've linked the album in the show notes to both Spotify and Apple Music. And what we like to do is we like to pause halfway through the album, and the album is split there's 12 songs on the album and split pretty evenly, six and six. And the album starts with Sure Enough and Yes I Do, and side one ends with the song Electricity. So if you're listening along, you want to pause it at that point, you can go ahead and do that. And I want to remind you, if you're enjoying the show, you can help us out on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress, and you can get these episodes the day before they go live, and lots of cool stuff there as well. You can pick an album for us to review, and lots of interesting things going on there. And check out the website. Go to polyphonicpress.com so you can get all the previous episodes. And so without further ado... All right, so here we go. Here's the first song on the album, Sure Enough and Yes I Do. Okay, and ending side one with Electricity. This is I really like this. You know, it's
I figured you would.
It's not as weird as I thought it would be.
But it is a little weird.
It is a little weird. Yeah, it's just the right amount of weird. It's because what was the song? I'm Glad.
Yeah,
that's like a soul song.
Yeah,
like
the Black Keys R&B. Covered that one. In fact, they covered another song on this album. I can't remember what the other one was, but yeah, they. I know. Dan Auerbach is a big fan of this album in particular, but he's a big fan of like Captain Beefheart stuff.
I can hear the influence on them from this for sure. Absolutely.
Ry Cooter's guitar playing has definitely come through on his guitar playing. So especially his slide playing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I can definitely hear that. It's a little more, I guess it's a little more rock than was expecting. I don't know why I was expecting it to not be. I thought it was going to, I don't know, for some reason I had this idea of Captain Beefheart of just being this cacophony of noise.
That's Trout Mask Replica. We'll probably have given you that. Did you ever listen to that?
I've heard parts of it.
Okay,
I haven't heard the whole thing.
It might come up. That'll be an interesting. I mean, I enjoy it just because it's just plain bizarre, but I wouldn't, it's not one of those albums you just put on for the sake of putting on, unless you're like really strange. So it's a trip for sure. But this one is definitely more approachable. So
yeah, I can definitely hear that. I guess this is sort of a good introduction to his stuff. Around this time, like that box set, that Nuggets box set. I don't know, I could be wrong about this, but there's like a couple of different types of psychedelic music. There's like the psychedelic pop, and then there's like the garage rock that had a little bit of experimentation, and that this is a little bit more like that. But then there's the way out there stuff,
and everything in between.
And I feel like this is one of those things that's kind of in between. This is like that last song, Electricity. It wasn't that weird using the theremin there, but a little weird.
It's definitely psychedelic.
It's unusual. It's not really weird. It's just unusual. It's not a typical thing, especially at that time. Like a theremin was used mostly for film soundtracks at that point.
It wasn't really until, I mean, obviously it gets used here because, you know, Captain Beefheart's kind of he's a bit of a sociopath, but he's an odd duck, and he'd pick something like that. And I kind of like that about him. But yeah, it wasn't really not until Jimmy Page started playing with one. Then you started to see a little bit more of an explosion in them. But again, it's still a pretty small explosion. It's a cherry bomb going off as opposed to a nuke.
Right. Yeah. Because it wasn't that long after this that Whole Lot of Love came out.
No, it came out 69. Yeah.
At that time, like psychedelic music had been around for maybe a year at this point. Certainly in the underground in 65, 66.
Yeah. And psychedelic rock anyway.
Psychedelic rock. Yeah. Cause when was the 13th Floor Elevators? That album was, I think is considered the first, psychedelic rock album.
Yeah. It was 66, but honestly there's stuff that kind of goes along with that. Like, garage rock was, the Monks. In Germany, I'm talking about the British or the American Monks stationed in Germany. They put out their first album in 66 as well. I don't know if that was quite psychedelic, but it's definitely a garage rock, sort of a proto-punk. But that sort of goes. The two were very, very well meshed together at the time. Like it was experimental rock and roll. Yeah, I would say it got its big push in 66, certainly when the Beatles started experimenting on Revolver with, turn off your mind and relax and float downstream.
And we'll talk a little bit about that. I did mention when we talk about some of the facts about the album, there is a Beatles connection to this album. The critical reception of the album at the time, it wasn't a hit at the time. Let's just say that it's one of those albums that has become a classic. It wasn't really anything when it came out.
Cult classic. It didn't make any splashes. And I think it probably as approachable as this is, compared to Captain Beefheart's other stuff, it was still a little out there for the average listener.
Yeah. Yeah, it was Like, I can't find any reviews on it from the time that it was released. I don't know if it was even...
on anybody's radar, really?
Yeah, I don't know if it was on anyone's radar. It was... It just seemed like one of those things that if you know about it, you know about it. But if you're just, like a high school kid that's kind of sheltered, you wouldn't, it's not being played on top 40 radio. That's for sure. So I couldn't find any reviews about it, at the time that it came out.
I think this album mostly got its push, I mean, through the musician community and stuff like that, people who really, you know, like weirder stuff. The fact that John Lennon liked it, that gave it a push. Some of the songs appearing on the Nuggets collection in the 70s, that gave it a push. But before that, it was pretty underground. So,
like, I know we kind of always sort of talk about this, but it is interesting to think about, like, what, you know, if it were to come out today. I honestly think it would be pretty tame if it came out today. Like, I don't think it would. It might, like, the song "I'm Glad," that might be a hit as a throwback sort of R&B kind of thing.
Some of the other stuff, yeah. I think it might do well amongst people who listen to, like, King Gizzard or stuff like that. I say that a lot, but it's true. I mean, people who listen to those people, they dig this sort of stuff.
Honestly, yeah, like the neo-psychedelic movement. And I think that stuff is starting to become a little more popular. I was looking through Rolling Stone magazine, and I can't remember the name of the band. Well, the name of the band was Goose, but they're a relatively new band, but they're like a jam band, but they're getting reviewed in Rolling Stone magazine. So, like, you know, that stuff is kind of becoming a little more popular than it was maybe a few years ago.
Yeah. But again, it's Rolling Stone. They've always kind of, I mean, Rolling Stone's sort of like the pop side of the, between underground and popular, it's still really much rock and roll. So when something rock and roll comes along, whether it's psychedelic rock or classic rock or whatever like that, they're on top of it, whether they like it or not, but they're on top of it. They've heard it.
So if this were to really be released today, I think it would fit in well. I think it would be in that sort of niche of, like, it might get reviewed in Rolling Stone and say, hey, this, check out this new psychedelic band, or this psychedelic album.
Would it get played on top 40, though? No.
It wouldn't get played on top 40, but, you know, a lot of stuff, like you said, a lot of stuff that Rolling Stone covers doesn't. So they kind of straddle that line of being almost like covering mainstream stuff, but also covering the sort of weird offbeat stuff as well. So, so I did manage to find a few facts about the album. Rye Cooter, played on this, and he was 20 years old when he played on this. He was very young. A young Rye Cooter, later known for his slide guitar mastery and solo work, played on Safe as Milk at just 20 years old. He was a stabilizing force during the sessions and even served as a kind of musical director, helping to translate Beefheart's unconventional ideas into playable parts. I think his contribution is probably why this album is not as weird as it could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, like, Rye Cooter is not someone who strayed away from the weird for the most part, but he definitely, being in the room with someone as weird as Captain Beefheart is, he would be definitely trying to make it a little bit more approachable, but he wouldn't be trying to, like, he wouldn't be, you know, Mike loving it, like, what's his name? Yeah, Mike Love from the Beach Boys.
Not trying to make it a top 40 thing, but, like, hey, let's
tone down the squawking for a little bit and actually play our instruments.
Let's see if we can make an actual song out of this.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, smashing a filing cabinet with a ball peen hammer is all great and fun and everything.
Fun as that is, but can we get back to the music? The album was originally going to be on Buddha Records, which on Wikipedia, it says that it was released on Buddha Records, but it was originally going to be Safe as Milk was initially supposed to be released by Buddha Records, who wanted to promote the band to the pop market. However, after hearing the final recordings, which were weirder and darker than expected, they dropped the project. It was ultimately released on Buddha's subsidiary, Kama Sutra Records, instead. Okay, that's okay.
Yeah, Buddha was the pop stuff. Kama Sutra was the more underground sort of thing. So, yes, actually, that does make sense.
I didn't know this. So the song Electricity got them kicked off the Monterey Pop Festival.
That's weird. Why?
The band's performance of the song Electricity at a soundcheck for the Monterey Pop Festival was so intense and unhinged that it reportedly scared the organizers. Beefheart froze mid-song, claiming he saw a girl turn into a fish, and the band was removed from the festival lineup as a result.
Oh, man. That's sort of a shame.
Yeah, so they were going to play, but, you know, because their soundtrack was so weird, they got kicked off.
Oh, man, that's really a shame. Kind of reminds me of the Poppers, a band from Toronto who played the Monterey Pop Festival. I don't know if there's footage of them at all. I would love to see it, even though apparently their bass player, who is notorious for screwing up their gigs, screwed up the gig.
What did he do?
Oh, he was just on acid.
Oh, okay.
Just completely tripped out and everything. He's okay. This guy, Denny Girard, played bass with the Poppers and the very first album and everything, and he was considered probably like the Jimi Hendrix of the bass at the time. People were considering him like that. He was unreliable to a detrimental extent. He would disappear while they were on tour. They wouldn't know where he was. They'd run out of money. They'd have to come back to Toronto, and then they'd get a call from Denny Girard wondering where the hell he is.
All right. Okay. Wow.
Another time he was testing out a wireless system for a bass, and he just decided to walk down, I don't know, Yonge Street or something like that, to see how far he could go until the signal cut out on his amp. Well, he just kept walking, and then they lost him again. This was a regular occurrence with this guy. So they had to fire him and pick some of them. But anyway, he tanked there. He was completely out of it at the Monterey Pop Festival. And I don't know if there's any footage that survives of it. If there is, I want to see it.
That was actually pretty common with a lot of people in the 60s.
Yeah, I know.
Who they would do acid and it would just completely fuck them up.
The original Fleetwood Mac had that happen to them several times.
Yeah, there was one of their guitar players
joined a cult.
Yeah, I was just going to say he disappeared from a rehearsal and he wound up they found him like a year later in this cult.
That was Jeremy Spencer, yeah. And then Peter Green himself, he started going a little bit weird towards the end of his tenure in the band. Wanted the whole band to donate all the money to, I don't know, I can't remember what it was, but it was not a good move for the band, and the band front plate sort of, he left the band. I don't know if whether they kicked him out or anything. I think they didn't kick him out because he was the band leader, but he left because the rest of the band didn't want to go along with what he wanted to do at the time.
So there is a Beatles connection. So John Lennon was a big fan of Safe as Milk. He listed it as one of his favorite albums in interviews, and it's said that he played it frequently during the White Album sessions. The Beatles' growing experimentalism around that time may have been influenced in part by Beefheart's boundary-pushing style. So I guess we can blame Captain Beefheart for Revolution 9.
Well, yeah, partly.
The other thing that is interesting is the album actually has a bizarre abandoned sequel So Captain Beefheart had plans for a follow-up album called It Comes to You in a Plain Brown Wrapper, which would have continued the experimental vibe of Safe as Milk. While the original sessions were scrapped, some of the songs later resurfaced in altered form on later albums, including Mirror Man and Strictly Personal.
Are they original, like, recordings, or are they, like, redone? I think it said that they were, like, redone songs.
Yeah, I think the original sessions were scrapped. Some of the songs later resurfaced. Yeah, they would have been re-recorded.
Hmm. Boy, I'd love to hear some of those original recordings.
Yeah. So those are some of the interesting facts that I found. So I guess we'll get into side two of the album. But before we do that, let's hear from our friend Jess over at Music Notes with Jess. So check that out.
Hi, I'm Jessica Ann Katina. I've always loved music and surround myself with it every day. I've sung in choirs, took digital musical classes in college, and used to work in radio. To further share my knowledge and experience with others, I created this podcast, Music Notes with Jess, in 2019. I'm so fortunate of the listener growth and hearing back from some of the celebs I discussed in past episodes. That's why now I'm ready to expand. So let's have fun taking weekly music notes of throwbacks, modern hits, and media. Thank you. Talk to you soon on Music Notes with Jess.
We'll now take a few seconds before we begin side two. Thank you. Here's side two.
Okay. All right. And ending the album with Autumn's Child. Yeah, this is really, really interesting.
But it's good, right?
It is good. It is good. I do like it. Yeah. Yeah. I don't really know what to say. I mean, that American male singers in the 60s had, and that's kind of all over this.
Captain Beefheart's voice is pretty unique, but some of the other voices that come in are a little more, I don't know, it's got probably to do with the production sound and the equipment they were using that just has a certain quality to it that you're picking up on.
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is like the song Grown So Ugly. I mean, that was, yeah.
I love that song. It's another one the Black Keys covered.
Yeah, it's so weird, but it's so cool at the same time. You know, yeah, I'll be honest, I don't know quite what to make of it. I think it's one of those, it's hard to sort of quantify it on one listen.
Right.
On the first listen. But what I do hear and what I can say is that I do enjoy it. Like I do really like it. It's and I think it's one of those things. It's like the TV show, like Arrested Development or Community, where the more times you watch it, the more you
pick up. Yeah. No. It's definitely that sort of a thing. And probably with the same amount of approachability too. Like, not everybody's going to be into it, but those people who are probably going to be really into it because it is actually really good.
Even maybe by today's standards, it's a little, it's out there. It's weird. Cause you know, sometimes things like when rock and roll itself was presented, people thought it was weird, but now it's sort of like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's rock and roll. So as time goes on, as when something comes out and it's perceived as weird or shocking, you know, the more time people get used to it, I don't think that's the case here. I think, you know, because like the psychedelic experimental music that really didn't, it continued in a way, and it continued into progressive rock in a way that was a little more, for lack of a better term, palatable to a casual listener. And if you were to play like Fragile by Yes or The Dark Side of the Moon to someone now, they whether they're into it or not, they wouldn't necessarily think it's weird music. Whereas this, I think if you were to play this for someone now, they would still think that this is weird. It didn't lose its weirdness with time.
Oh, and I love it. No, it's exactly the sort of stuff that, I don't know, if I had a band, I would be pulling out stuff like this, not necessarily by them. Although, you know, some of the stuff by them, yeah, sure, why not? But it's the sort of thing that I think is still kind of fresh because it's just not overdone.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's still, you're right, it still has such a niche audience. It's not overdone. It's not like, you know, corporations were selling a watered down version of Captain Beefheart, right? Like a lot of,
you can't even say Frank Zappa was that.
Right. So yeah, I think this is one of those things that's a hidden gem. And I think it's, if you're into it, you're into it. And if you're not, like, it's definitely not for everybody. And you're either going to, you can't just be a casual fan of it. You either love it or you absolutely hate it.
Well, I can imagine someone saying, it's okay, but it's a little weird.
Yeah. Yeah. True. True.
So I can actually imagine that, but I know what you mean.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, you either get it or you don't.
So this might be a difficult task, but what would be your three standout tracks?
Always loved Zigzag Wanderer. That's a good song. Dropout Boogie's always got me. And Grown So Ugly is just hilarious. I love that song. I think I'm going to pick those three.
Okay. All right.
But there's other ones I love as well. It is a little tough.
I think mine would be Grown So Ugly because that's just, it's hilarious. I would go Electricity.
That's good. Yep.
And yeah, I think I would pick Dropout Boogie too. I mean, that's, yeah. So those would be my three. It's tough, but yeah.
Yeah.
Upon first listen, which is one of those albums that requires multiple listens, which I think I just answered the question, would you listen to this again?
I have. In fact, I feel like I still need to listen to it again. It's one of those albums that when you hear it, you want to hear it again.
Yeah.
For me, anyway.
Yeah, for me too. I think I have to hear this again. There's just so much that I have to hear it again. It's so different, but so good that I want to hear what else is going on, basically. So yeah, I guess we'll end the episode there. Thank you so much for listening. If you made it this far, be sure to subscribe and leave us a rating and review if you feel inclined, because that really helps us, helps new listeners find us. And you can always go to go to the website, polyphonicpress.com, and you can check out all the past episodes and get updates on what's going on. And you can also help us out on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress. Got lots of cool perks there. And yeah, I think that pretty much does it. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.